Surrounded by Israel and Egypt, most Palestinians in Gaza have never been allowed to leave the enclave. The fabricated regime of Israel even controls its airspace and territorial borders. The blockade has devastated Gaza's economy and prompted what the United Nations has termed de-development, a situation in which development is not merely impeded, but actively reversed. This has left nearly half of the population unemployed, with the rate exceeding 70% among youth. For many Palestinians in Gaza, life is a struggle for survival. Between 2007 and 2010, the Zionist regime's authorities maintained a calorie count of Palestinians' nutritional requirements to ensure that they only received the bare minimum of food to avoid starvation. And in just the first 6 months of 2023, nearly 400 children in Gaza were denied permits to go to the occupied West Bank for urgent health care. As if the blockade wasn't enough, the Zionist regime carried out protracted military onslaughts against Gaza in 2008 to 2009, 2012, 2014, and 2021, killing thousands of people and exacerbating already dire living conditions by crippling the territory's infrastructure. Homes, schools, and hospitals have been destroyed, while attempts to rebuild have been hampered by the Zionist regime's refusal to allow construction materials, such as steel and cement, into Gaza. In 2014, the Zionist regime targeted Gaza's sole power plant, aggravating an energy crisis that persists to this day, with an average of only 13 hours of electricity a day. While the physical carnage caused by the Zionist regime's brutal assaults has been extensively documented, far less attention has been given to the human toll and the psychological devastation wrought upon an entire generation. An 18-year-old in Gaza is now living through their fifth major Israeli regime assault. They have seen friends and family massacred by Israeli regime missiles, artillery shells, and sniper rounds. Meanwhile, 9 out of 10 children in Gaza suffer from debilitating conflict-related trauma. With children accounting for around half of Gaza's population, the future for many is bleak. The torture of Gaza, however, is only part of the story. Under the direct protection of the Zionist regime's military and with explicit encouragement from Israel's far-right leaders, Zionist settlers have carried out deadly programs in Palestinian towns such as Hawara. In recent months, entire communities between Ramallah and Ariha have been cleared out by Zionist settler violence. Even before October 7th, 2023 was shaping up to be the deadliest year for Palestinians since the UN started tracking fatalities in 2006. Across historic Palestine, the fabricated regime of Israel has been tightening its occupation and basking in the glow of impunity. Now, by remaining silent as the Israeli regime renders Gaza unlivable, the international community is condemning Palestinians to a hopeless future. Those lucky enough to survive Israel's unprecedented assault have nowhere to go. The Zionist regime's military has laid waste to much of northern Gaza, destroying half of the buildings and obliterating entire neighborhoods. Gaza's already overburdened critical infrastructure has been shattered, and after forcing hundreds of thousands of civilians to flee northern Gaza, the Israeli regime is now gearing up to turn its attention to the south. By allowing the Israeli regime to get away with genocide, the international community is complicit in creating a new crisis that will make the pre-7 October status quo pale in comparison.
the ugly face of the occupation. Freedom of media in the Palestinian territories is still closely related and influenced by the Israeli occupation and settlers, and their continuous violations against Palestinian journalists and media institutions. Being a journalist, regardless of nationality, is a job that is full of dangers and obstacles. It is also the job of truth seekers. The Palestinian journalist is destined to live within the walls of these violations. But despite these hard conditions, he or she still has determination, boldness, persistence, and strength.
The reality is that Palestinian journalists have a double suffering. On one hand, they are part of the Palestinian people who are subject to crimes and violations that qualify to genocide and war crimes. On the other hand, they have a dangerous job, especially in this hard environment under which Palestinians live because of the occupation. The Gaza Strip is besieged, while in the West Bank there is the apartheid wall, settlements, Judaization of Jerusalem, frequent violations and arrests. This affects the entire Palestinian society, and especially the journalists, as the occupation wants to black out the truth and their violations of human rights, as well as the state terrorism it practices. The Israeli occupation practiced all sorts of humiliation and subjugation methods on journalists. But along the years, the Palestinian journalist refused becoming a tool in the hands of the occupation and Israeli intelligence. And this made journalists sacrifice a lot. The Palestinian journalist plays a role as significant as that of the Palestinian politician or the fighter. To each his role. We have always seen the Palestinian journalist in the field. He would use his cameras and other tools to perform heroic and honorable achievements. He would always document and publicize the suffering of the Palestinian people, especially in the besieged Gaza Strip. He would always show the world the suffering, the incursions, the killing and torture Palestinians suffer on the hands of the Israeli occupation.
This boldness made the Israeli occupation army not differentiate between a journalist and another. So everyone is targeted and everyone is wanted.
Regardless of their nationality, journalists pursue finding the truth, removing injustice, and unveiling crimes of the occupation, no matter who that occupation may be. We have seen examples for that where reporters for networks in the United States and Europe expose crimes committed by the U.S. and other countries. An exception to this is the few journalists who are affiliated with their government, no matter who that government may be. Such journalists have a questionable credibility and are renounced in their communities. Journalists who come to Palestine are our colleagues and friends. We have to help them, and the Israeli occupation has to respect their freedom of movement and work, like it respects our freedom. But unfortunately, the Israeli occupation, as you know, does not respect any kind of freedom, and it continues its violations against these journalists. The Israeli occupation does not differentiate between a Palestinian and a non-Palestinian journalist. The non-Palestinian journalist tries to document the events as they are, so the Israeli occupation relentlessly targets them and any other journalist who tries to document events on the ground without discrimination. The Palestinian journalist works in an area rich with events. There are incursions and airstrikes all the time. And as a journalist tries to cover these crimes, he will be a target to the Israeli occupation. The Israeli occupation does not want the journalist to succeed in covering these violations, because any footage that comes out of the Gaza Strip exposes the Israeli occupation's army. That is why, in the beginning of any incursion, they fire and attack journalists to get them away from the action zone so they cannot document these incursions or any targeting of civilians. Therefore, if they injure the journalist, he would be taken to the hospital and there will be no one to document the events, so the occupation army can do whatever they want. If journalists were there, this means there were witnesses on the crime. There are no witnesses on the crime as long as there are no journalists. Palestinian journalists have been subject to a variety of violations that reached the killing in cold blood. Other violations include arrest and detention for extended periods, especially the administrative detention with no accusation, as well as confiscation of their media coverage badges, especially in the West Bank. Journalists face continuous violations similar to the case during their coverage of the war on Gaza or the usual occupation's incursions to the Palestinian areas. Many of them were injured while covering the events, and some of these injured journalists lost their ability to perform their job.
Assassination of journalists in general is part of the repulsive occupation, because Palestinian journalists actually like the job, which unveils the ugly face of the occupation, and have determination and persistence. The Israeli occupation just assassinates them. They kill them to kill the truth. This is how the occupation envisions killing and assassinating them.
During the attack on Jabalia, there was an incursion in Azbat Abu Drabbu right behind us. We were covering the incursion on the first and second day. It seems that the Israeli occupation army did not like our movement in the area, so they fired at us multiple times. But we continued documenting this crime. I was standing right here when the tanks advanced a little further. They saw me, and right away one of the tanks fired a shell directly towards me. After I was taken to the hospital, I was surprised that the shell also hit other people and they were killed. When I woke up and became conscious, I realized that my best friend and the rest of the team were also injured. After that, we went back to the field and continued working. These violations and targeting of journalists are not going to stop us from doing our work. By the way, this building we are in right now was hit and targeted by the Israeli occupation during the war on the Gaza Strip. Other colleagues were on the roof of this building and were targeted as well while covering the events. However, none of us, the journalists, our colleagues who were targeted, their families, or even the Palestinian Authority took judicial action. So there is weakness or failure in this side. We have to encourage families of victims, civil society organizations, the journalist syndicate, and the Palestinian Authority to take judiciary action against the Israeli occupation's war criminals. These Israeli war criminals should not remain unpunished. We can generally say that these violations frequently committed by the Israeli occupation against Palestinian journalists are evidence that it tries to cover the truth and isolate Palestine from its surrounding. The occupation isolated the Gaza Strip through the siege and isolates the West Bank from time to time. Despite all these hardships, Palestinian journalists played their role in delivering the message and suffering of Palestinian people, as well as documenting the violations that exposed the Israeli occupation. Therefore, the camera was able to expose the organized terrorism, war crimes, and crimes against humanity committed by the Israeli occupation. Claims were filed on the issue of targeting journalists, especially those from Al-Aqsa Association, but procrastination has always prevailed in these cases. There were also claims by local and international organizations, but these also were put aside, especially the ones regarding Al-Aqsa Association. The justification given most of the time, among others, was that a counterclaim of the one presented is filed. This is evidence that there are restrictions on journalists and their claims, especially those from Al-Aqsa Association. The Israeli occupation is a renegade state practicing state terrorism according to the international humanitarian law. However, the balance of powers with the United States hegemony blocks any attempts to sue the Israeli occupation in the United Nations, especially in the Security Council. Using Article 7 of the international law would force the Israeli occupation to subdue and abide to the international conventions and the international humanitarian law. When the issue on the table concerns an Arab country or so, the United Nations decisions are enforced immediately, and forces like UNIFIL would deploy to employ decisions of the Security Council. In the Palestinian case, everything is pending, and no serious sanctions were enforced to prevent the Israeli occupation from committing more crimes against Palestinians. And this provides a shield for the occupation to carry on.
Israeli occupation's violations presented a dangerous threat to the lives of many journalists while performing their job, as they were targeted with bullets, tear gas, and stun grenades, and many of them were critically injured. During the war in 2009, the Israeli occupation targeted journalists and media facilities. One of the most important media companies targeted is the Media Group company, which was directly targeted with a rocket.
Many of the journalists in Media Group company were targeted on various occasions. One of our cameramen was targeted with a tank shell, and he almost got killed. During our coverage of the war on Gaza, end of 2008 and early 2009, the Media Group office was shelled. We were supplying coverage for 20 satellite channels and international news agencies. The place was shelled, despite the lighting and the clear signs in Arabic, English, and Hebrew that there are journalists in this place. The Israeli occupation's shell, a rocket, fell only 8 meters away from us, thanks to Allah. Otherwise, we would have been all dead.
ولولا ستر الله لكنا احدث اصابات هائله او يعني قتلنا جميعا
لحظه من اللحظات لما نزل الصاروخ
At some point after the rocket hit the office, I did not feel any kind of pain. I started to wake up and look around the place. Everything was black and I didn't know what happened to us and whether both the 13th and 14th floor were hit. Then little by little, we started to check on each other and I turned out to be injured in my arm only, which is a relief. Then we found out that Ayman was hit in the head, so we tried to stop his bleeding and could barely carry him down the stairs from the 13th floor and then put him in a car and took him to the hospital.
The Israeli occupation had not had enough terrifying and scaring civilians, but it continued the unjustified targeting of the media offices and facilities. Al-Aqsa TV channel, affiliated with Hamas, was directly targeted with rockets, which made it stop its transmission, and this makes the violation reach the level of killing through both bullets and rockets.
Both Al-Aqsa TV channel and Al-Aqsa satellite channel were targeted. Al-Aqsa satellite channel was hit with an F-16 airstrike in the first hours of the war, and half an hour later, the TV channel was targeted. Three floors of the four-story building were totally destroyed. There was nobody in the building at that moment, but all the equipment and devices were destroyed in this sudden strike. There was a new fully equipped studio. We were about to commence, but it was also destroyed. As soon as the war started, we evacuated the building and moved to another place where the satellite transmission vehicle parked there was also targeted. We used other alternatives to continue working, but this was very exhausting to our crews.
أرهق الطاقة الصحفي بشكل قوي جدا.
زميلنا فضل شناعة كيف قتل؟
Our colleague فضل شناعة was killed by the Israeli occupation tank shells while he was holding his camera and trying to document war crimes committed against Palestinian victims. This direct targeting of journalists continues, and it is the most dangerous type of violations that the occupation practices. Other violations include prevention from traveling and restricting freedom of movement. There are plenty of examples on that, like Abdul Latif Ghaith, one of the founders of the Journalist Syndicate, who has been prevented from leaving Jerusalem for years. Journalists suffer from other violations on a daily basis while covering events in the field.
The Israeli occupation committed various violations against Palestinian journalists and reporters, as some of them were prevented from coverage, traveling, and participation. The Israeli occupation is continuing these outrageous and inhumane practices.
The Israeli occupation uses various methods to target and humiliate Palestinian journalists, like banning coverage, breaking into their offices, harassing them on checkpoints, not permitting part of the crew to pass, and preventing coverage inside Al-Aqsa Mosque. In 2010 and 2011, all equipment and part of the footage were confiscated at the gates of Al-Aqsa Mosque multiple times. Footage and filmed materials were also confiscated from the journalists covering the protests in Belaim and other demonstrations against the apartheid wall and others. All the equipment and materials, like footage and films, were confiscated in all these events. The Israeli occupation tried everything with Palestinian journalists, from killing, targeting, and humiliation, but they could never break their determination and persistence. Otherwise, you would have seen Palestinian journalists run away and sit at home during the Israeli occupation's war in the Gaza Strip. But on the contrary, they have always been in the field, and their numbers are increasing. This shows that Palestinian journalists are ready to sacrifice for this just cause and to make the world see the truth. Everyone is a target, despite the immunity and protection provided for journalists by both the international humanitarian law and the Fourth Geneva Convention. There are two forms of protection. The first is that journalists are civilians and are entitled to all rights of civilians. The other form of protection is that provided by the Fourth Geneva Convention for journalists, women, and children under occupation or in armed conflict zones. Despite all that, we find that the Israeli occupation does not respect the international humanitarian law with the hideous help and bias of the United States and the silence that qualifies to a crime. All this encourages the Israeli occupation to carry on with its violations and not respect the minimum level of humanitarian principles and the international humanitarian law.
In the past 10 years, the Israeli occupation killed about 20 journalists, in addition to committing hundreds of physical and vocal violations and continuing hindering journalists and reporters from performing their jobs.
Oh,
the last 3 years, between 2009 and 2011, the Israeli occupation committed 336 violations against journalists and media institutions and killed 4 journalists in early 2009 during the war.
Why does not the Israeli occupation target Israeli journalists who cover internal events and issues? Why are other journalists covering events in Europe or the United States not targeted? Palestinian journalists are the only ones to be targeted, and the United States is silent about it and provides cover for the occupation from being legally punished. I believe that what stopped the war on Gaza was the Palestinian journalist, not politicians or political negotiations. Journalists played a significant role in documenting and reporting the events. They were subject to a lot of pressure. Many of them were killed, their equipment was destroyed, and their offices were targeted. But they stood tall above all that and performed a significant job reporting the reality of the events and the suffering of their people to the whole world.
Despite this horrific amount of violations of the different international conventions, the international community did not react to these violations and did not hold the Israeli occupation accountable for these crimes and killings of journalists. This silence encouraged the occupation to continue their violations to prevent journalists and reporters from covering and documenting the various crimes committed against Palestinians.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., Denver police are increasing security for members of the Colorado Supreme Court after last week's ruling that Donald Trump should be disqualified from running for president under the 14th Amendment. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster ABC News has covered this story and tells us more. Denver police are increasing security for members of the Colorado Supreme Court after last week's ruling that Donald Trump should be disqualified from running for president under the 14th Amendment. The Denver Police Department is currently investigating incidents directed at Colorado Supreme Court justices and will continue working with our local, state, and federal law enforcement partners to thoroughly investigate any reports of threats or harassment, Denver police said in a statement on Tuesday, 26th of December. The statement added, "Due to the open investigations and safety and privacy considerations, we will not be providing details of these investigations. The department is providing extra patrols around justices' residences in Denver and will provide additional safety support if and when requested." In a 4-3 ruling that could be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, a majority of Colorado's 7 justices wrote that the former president, Donald Trump, engaged in insurrection for his behavior on 6th of January 2021, ahead of scores of his supporters storming the U.S. Capitol. President Trump's direct and express efforts over several months exhorting his supporters to march to the Capitol to prevent what he falsely characterized as an alleged fraud on the people of his country were indisputably overt and voluntary, the justices wrote. Moreover, the evidence amply showed that President Trump undertook all these actions to aid and further a common unlawful purpose that he himself conceived and set in motion: prevent Congress from certifying the 2020 presidential election and stop the peaceful transfer of power. On Thursday, 21st of December, the FBI told ABC News it was working with local law enforcement in Colorado to monitor threats to the justices. The FBI is aware of the situation, working with local law enforcement, the agency said in a statement to ABC News. We will vigorously pursue, investigate any threat or use of violence committed by someone who uses extremist views to justify their actions, regardless of motivation. The four justices who voted in favor of removing Donald Trump from the primary ballot continued to receive threats over the weekend, even encouraging more violence in the wake of previous media reports. According to Site Intelligence Group, a site that tracks online activity of white supremacist organizations, threats included calls for the justices to be dragged from their homes, hanged, and shot, according to Site Intelligence Group. Colorado's four-justice majority predicted that the matter would wind up before the U.S. Supreme Court. They stayed the ruling until 4th of January 2024, saying it would maintain the status quo pending any review from the nation's highest court. USA Today has also covered the same story. Officials are investigating threats on Colorado's Supreme Court justices after their decision to disqualify former President Donald Trump from the 2024 presidential primary election, according to reports from multiple outlets. Online posts about violence towards the justices spread rapidly in the 24 hours after the decision was announced, according to an analysis by Advanced Democracy and reported by NBC News. The state Supreme Court decided on 19th of December that Donald Trump's actions leading up to the Capitol riot on 6th of January 2021 meant that he engaged in insurrection, disqualifying him from holding office under the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. The FBI is aware of the situation and working with local law enforcement, FBI spokesperson Vicky Migoya said in a statement emailed to USA Today. The statement added, "We will vigorously pursue investigations of any threat or use of violence committed by someone who uses extremist views to justify their actions, regardless of motivation." A Denver Police Department spokesperson told USA Today on Tuesday, 26th of December, that the department is increasing patrols near justices' homes in Denver and will provide additional support if requested. Denver police responded to a justice's home on Thursday, 21st of December, after an apparent hoax report. American newspaper The Hill has also covered this story and tells us more. The Denver Police Department said on Tuesday, 26th of December, it is investigating reports of threats or harassment against the Colorado Supreme Court justices and has increased patrols around their residences in Denver. In a statement, a spokesperson for the police department said, "It is providing extra patrols around the justices' residences in Denver and will provide additional safety support if and as requested." The heightened security precautions come as the justices face mounting threats in the wake of their controversial ruling that rendered former President Donald Trump ineligible to appear on the state's 2024 presidential primary ballot. in the 4-3 decision, which cited the insurrection clause of the 14th Amendment. The court ruled that Donald Trump engaged in an insurrection through his activities leading up to and on 6th of January 2021, when thousands of his supporters attacked the U.S. Capitol. The Denver Police Department said in a statement it was currently investigating incidents directed at Colorado Supreme Court justices and will continue working with our local, state, and federal law enforcement partners to thoroughly investigate any reports of threats or harassment. Due to the open investigations and safety and privacy considerations, we will not be providing details of this investigation, the statement added. The Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, said on Friday, 22nd of December, it was also investigating threats against the justices and was working with local law enforcement to pursue potential threats of violence. The FBI is aware of the situation and working with local law enforcement, said Vicky Migoya, a spokesperson for the FBI Denver field office, in a statement. Vicky Migoya added, "We will vigorously pursue investigations of any threat or use of violence committed by someone who uses extremist views to justify their actions, regardless of motivation." Following the decision, social media platforms were flooded with significant violent rhetoric against the chief court justices from Trump supporters, according to a report from nonpartisan research group Advanced Democracy, first obtained by NBC News. These online threats reportedly included multiple posts pledging to kill or maim the Denver Supreme Court justices. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to review the ruling, which the Trump campaign has vowed to swiftly appeal.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, When the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hauza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, my guest speaker as always. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We are still working on some of the jurisprudential laws about khums based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, is khums applicable to that kind of money which is saved from monthly salary to purchase some stuff, you know, for the wedding, for example, in the future?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, again, I should say that this is a matter of, you know, controversy among the Shia scholars. Some believe that khums should be paid on anything over which 1 year runs. And some other scholars of the view that no, as long as it's an essential thing and as long as you cannot buy it in the future and you want to buy it now to be prepared for the wedding,
mm-hmm.
so you don't have to pay khums on it. Now, this is the viewpoint of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. He says that, for example, if you save the money you receive as your monthly, for example, salary,
mm-hmm.
Of course, and in the event that you want to use the money to buy necessary items for your wedding within several days, for example,
yes.
You don't have to pay khums. For example, today is your khums date, and you're supposed to calculate all the asset and money that you have saved up.
Yes.
But maybe after a week or maybe after 10 days, you are going to buy something for your wedding. So you will not be able to buy it if you spend your money or if you pay khums on the money.
Mm-hmm.
So within several days, you are going to buy it. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, it's not necessary to pay khums on the money, which is saved for that very purpose.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Yes.
Only for the wedding, you mean? Like, what about the necessities of life? Does it also apply to that kind of money saved?
Of course, in the answer given by His Eminence, he has just mentioned the term, he has used the term wedding, you know.
Mm.
But, you know, when it
I understand if it is saved, if the money is saved for luxurious life, like items.
Yeah.
Like if you're going to, for example, live a life of luxury, that's a different story.
That's a different story, yeah.
But what about the necessities of
life? For example, you want to buy a washing machine, which you need. You can't wash your clothes.
You can't ignore this.
You need a refrigerator,
mm-hmm.
and also some, let's say, rugs or carpets.
Yes.
You can't live in your house without a carpet. So These are essential items, okay? And no one is going to blame you for buying these things, okay?
Yes.
These are not something in addition, luxurious.
Yes.
Every individual must have or needs to have something like a carpet or rug or refrigerator to live a comfortable life, mm-hmm. not a luxurious life. So he does not have to pay khums on the money that goes towards buying these things.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. There's another question, Sheikh Javid. We all know that it's mentioned in the book Tahrir al-Masira, written by Ayatollah Imam Khomeini, that a woman's dowry is not subject to khums.
Yeah.
But, you know, the question is, it didn't specify whether it's for the dowry that is paid at the time of the marriage or deferred.
You're right.
Would you please explain this?
Well, we do know that that the dowry or mahar, which is fixed by both parties to the marriage, is either paid immediately by the husband, or it is a kind of deferred payment, which is paid by the husband at a, you know, at any time upon demand. Okay, the wife demands. And once the dowry to be paid, the husband will have to pay it because it's a debt which the husband has to pay it. If he does not pay it, he will be liable for it. Now, it doesn't make any difference whether the pay is, for example, is due, whether it is the money has to be paid immediately or it's paid at a later time. In either case, according to all religious scholars, there is no khums paid on dowry. No khums is payable on mahr. This is a matter of consensus.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Shavit. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Shahid, our guest speaker. We're still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to khums based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, if an individual at the time that he was alive, he recorded or she recorded in their diary the amount of homes they owed.
Yes.
And, of course, those individuals, they were determined to pay it, but they died. All right?
Yes.
After their death, their family, their entire family, with the exception of one, for example, daughter,
yes,
refused to pay the jukhums. And they are using the state for their own use and the deceased expenses, as well as other things. Would you please tell our audience about Ayatollah Khomeini's opinion regarding this matter?
And this is a very good issue. If the deceased person has provided in his will that a part of his property is to be paid for khums, or actually the heirs are certain that the deceased owed an amount of khums, it is necessary that they act accordingly. Of course, they are not permitted under any circumstances to use the estate before they carry out the deceased's or the deceased person's will. So they should pay the khums that deceased person owed. And of course, it's necessary that they seriously determine to settle the khums debt and execute the will without carelessness. You know, it is very urgent and also very important that the heirs should act according to the will left by the husband, by the man of the family or by the individual.
Mm.
So, if he has any debt to be paid, it should be paid off. If he has khums amount to be paid during his lifetime, yes. But he failed to do so because he was ill, he couldn't make time to do it. It's necessary that the heirs should take immediate action to relieve him of this obligation to pay the khums.
Yes.
You see, they cannot, for example, the heirs cannot refuse to abide or to confiscate the property and avoid paying khums.
I see. Okay. There's another question. Let me ask at the end of this episode. Is it obligatory for employees having a surplus of money remaining over their annual expenses to pay khums in light of the fact that they still owe some money, which is due, or should be paid in installments?
Well, if the debt incurred during the year due to borrowing money for expenditure of the same year or due to purchase of some necessities for the same year on credit, it is subtracted from the remaining income at the end of the year. Because as long as you, for example, buy something on credit and then the salary is used to pay off the debt in the same year, not the previous year, because that we have to differentiate between the loan received in this year or the money borrowed in this year or the money borrowed in the previous year. If you pay off your debt which you owed even last year or the year before last with the salary you received in this year, of course you have to pay khums from the salary.
Mm.
But if you buy something on credit or if you borrow money in the same year in which you are earning money, now you don't have to pay khums because you need to pay installments. You need to pay off the debt first.
Yes.
And then if there's anything left, you will have to pay khums. Otherwise, you are not liable for khums. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Shastri. And thank you for joining us for the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We bid you farewell. Keep us in your du'as. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو رحيم محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.